Hello and welcome to the Unbundled Attorney Mastermind Podcast. My name is Dave Ahrens and I'm the co-founder and CEO of Unbundled Attorney. In this podcast, we interview many of our provider attorneys, as well as some of the leading experts in the industry to isolate the best practices for building internet-generated leads and how to ethically and effectively offer unbundled legal services and other more affordable options in your practice. For more information about our services, visit www.unbundledattorney.com. All right. Welcome, everyone. This is going to be an excellent episode with Mr. Marcus Tarigian, one of our provider attorneys out of Fresno, California. And this is essentially a two-part episode because Marcus takes both family law leads and immigration leads. And the first half of the episode, we talk about his process for family law leads. And the second half of the episode, we talk about his immigration process, which is very different. And that's one of the things that we dive into on this episode is what are the differences in the process to be effective in fielding a family law lead versus an immigration lead. And there are very specific differences, and me and Marcus discuss those. So if you're either new to fielding immigration leads or you're fielding immigration leads right now, this is a great episode for you to get some more tips and strategies for how you can make the adjustments necessary to be effective and convert immigration leads into paying clients. One of the other highlights of this call is Marcus will dive directly into his three-tier system that he uses for tailoring his services to the needs of his clients in the family law arena. And so those three tiers are basically three separate price points based upon what the client can afford. So, you know, he goes into what those price points are, the amount of services he delivers, the types of options that are encompassed in each tier. And so for those of you that are also looking for ideas on ways in which you can also start working with more clients by offering more creative, flexible, unbundled options, he's going to get into specifics on exactly how he does that and what those price points are so you can get some more ideas on how to do that. So this is a great episode. He's been working with us for a long time, has developed some great strategies, is a straight talker, and has a lot of great tips and practices that you can start implementing right away to make some changes. So with that, please enjoy this episode with provider attorney Marcus Tarigian out of Fresno, California. Hey, Marcus, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing extremely well. Glad that we got a chance to jump on and kind of dive into how things have been going. I think we've been working together for, gosh, it's been at least over a year now, isn't it?
Pretty close. I think so.
Yep. And so maybe a good place to start, Marcus, is you can give everyone a little bit of background on, you know, how you got started in the practice of law and the areas of law you focus on in the region and maybe something that, you know, you focus on your firm or something that makes you a little bit unique about the way you approach working with the clients.
Well, I got out of law school in 1993, and after passing the bar, I started practicing. My first job was with the district attorney's office in a county in Central California called Tulare County. People from the Central Valley will know that county very well, and practiced there for about 3 years, and that's where I really cut my teeth in litigation. Although it was criminal prosecution, you get a great opportunity being out in the courtroom every single day and getting the opportunity to do jury trials and court trials and all the like at a very high volume level. So over a three-year period, I was lucky enough to have quite a bit of opportunity there. And then I broke off from that office and started my own practice in 98-99, and practicing at the beginning all areas of law, as most people do when they first start practicing, and very quickly whittled my way back down to the areas of law that I felt most comfortable and what I enjoyed practicing the most, which is criminal defense, family law, and I've been doing more immigration lately. That has come along in the last few years. And I particularly enjoy the litigation aspect because that's where my comfort zone is in practicing, is in the sense of I'm very comfortable in the courtroom. I'm very very at ease dealing with judges, opposing parties, litigating issues, very comfortable with the evidence code. And so that's where my I'm really trying to play to my greatest strengths more than anything, and that's where my strengths are. And in family law and criminal law, luckily, you get an opportunity to be in the courtroom quite a bit. So I've had the opportunity over these 20-plus years to try many cases in both family law and criminal law, had very good success doing so. As it relates to the area of particularly family law, I've been doing that since I opened my private practice and handled every kind of family law case, do every type of area of the family, so it, and things that branch out even to ancillary parts of the family code, like conservatorships and guardianships and things like that. And there's some things that relate to criminal and family law, like CPS cases. So when you do that and you're dealing with families and parents and children and all those types of areas, you get to see a broad breadth of types of cases, get to meet all different types of people, and see quite a bit of different factual kind of scenarios that make you comfortable as cases come through your office now being, you know, years down the road, being able to give confident legal advice to people and real legal advice. And the motto of my office has been, since I practice, if you want to come into an attorney's office and let them and have that attorney tell you what you want to hear, I always tell them you're in the wrong place. If you want to have an attorney that's going to tell you what you need to hear and tell you the truth, then you're in the right place. And I can tell them that because I know what is real about cases and what's, not to mislead and not to give false expectations. And I think that's really a critical part of the lawyer's job, is to manage the expectation of the client so that they know, as they get involved in this litigation process, what to expect and how to go through it, because it's something that's new for them most times, or it's something that's very foreign to them, and you want to have somebody that's going to be a good shepherd in the process of doing that for them.
Right. Yeah, and I think most people, when you make it clear that you're going to be telling them the straightforward truth, I think that gives, for the most part, a lot more confidence in the fact that they know that you're not there to sugarcoat it. You're telling them, you're willing to tell them whether what you can and what you can't do, what it can't accomplish, and I would assume that makes them feel more confident with you, as opposed to attorneys that are willing to tell people whatever they want to hear to try to land a case.
Absolutely. There's always going to be, as the old phrase, there's always going to be people at the end of the bell-shaped curve at one side of it. They're going to want an attorney that tells them what they want to hear, but that doesn't mean that's going to be the result they get either. And it's my job, and I think it's incumbent upon anybody to give good advice and give good shepherding of a case, and have the client at the end of the case say, well, he told me he was going to do this, he did these things, and that's what happened, basically. And nobody can ever predict absolute outcomes, but you can at least give some kind of level of security and comfort to the person to know where their case is going, basically. And then on top
right.
of that, you have somebody that's familiar, in myself, with all the, the procedural codes, the evidentiary codes, and then more than anything in family law, which I think is very, very critical, if somebody who practices in the area knows the attorneys that you're going up against, if you're going up against opposing counsel, knows the judges, has relationships with the judges, and what I mean by that is not like friendships, but has had multiple cases with those judges, to know how each one of those judges thinks, because family law courts are courts of equity. The judge is the sole fact finder and arbitrator of these matters. So you need to know how these people think, each and every one of them, before a person dives into these things and says, well, I'm going to go in front of this judge and you really, I want to get this and I want to try and fight for that. Well, you need to know where that judge is coming from. And that's critical.
Okay. Well, the other thing here is, maybe we can kind of dive in a little bit, because you are doing an extremely great job with, the clients that we're sending you. So many of them are getting great feedback, and also you have an excellent conversion rate and have done well with both family law and the immigration leads we just started sending you. So maybe we could dive into a little bit about, kind of your process and how you go about working with the folks and shepherding them through the process that you described. So maybe a good place to start is, I know you're pretty busy with, your caseload and so forth, so you have some staff, right, that helps with the fielding of leads. So maybe, from the moment the lead comes in, who initially makes that call, and then from there, what is their goal in that initial call? You need to schedule them in for an appointment, or do they give them some information about the case? So maybe you can walk through just that initial step on how you go about contacting the clients as they come in.
I do have a staff. I have a receptionist at the office that basically gets the intake contact from Unbundled, contacts the client, makes immediate contact, gets them set up for a consultation, and then she does a more in-depth intake so that I can review through everything. So I'm familiar by the time the consultation occurs or is scheduled, whenever it's scheduled, to get right into it as quickly as possible. Typically what I do is anywhere from a half an hour to up to about 45-minute free consultation. And then what I do and what I've done in this situation is I kind of tier my help for these people if they're looking for my services. What I say is there's representation where if I'm going to help give you advice and guide you through the process, but you're not looking for an attorney to go to court and handle the whole case for you, there's one type of representation where we're going to help you go through everything and get you all prepared to do what you need to do in court and really walk them through it and give them a whole lot of materials that I have to help guide them through the process. There's another tier of my assistance would be we prepare all their documents for them, but they can go in pro per to court and represent themselves, but we prepare all their documents for them. And then the last right. one is we're preparing all the documents and going to court and doing everything for them, basically. So, and I offer that to any of the clients, whatever best suits their financial and their expectational needs, basically.
Right. And so your staff member, Denise or Jackie, whoever it is that makes the initial call, so their job is to get on the phone and find out the facts and basic, you know, ask main questions to get kind of an outline on the case. Do they also, you know, give the clients an expectation of on costs, or are they trained just to say, you know, that's something you can talk with Mr. Turgi and every case is a little bit different. You know, my job here is just to get some information about your case and then schedule you in to meet with him.
No, I typically talk cost with them. What they're really there to do is the first two things I need to know right off the bat is I need to understand the jurisdiction of the case, and I need to make sure it is, even though it's family law, it's something that I can provide some help with. Like, for instance, sometimes there are a few of these leads that they just came out of court, for instance, and they just got an order and they don't like it. Well, that's not really a go back to court. That might be an appeal issue or a writ issue potentially. So it's where is their case going to be? What kind of case do they have, or do they have a modification, or is this more of a guardianship case, or is this there's been a few contacts I've received where they're actually already in CPS court, and yet they're thinking about a modification. So you have to make sure you know where their jurisdiction is and what type of case they have, and then geography for me, because I limit it to three counties of work because of my familiarity. I have had a few that have called and they live in Fresno or live in Florida, but their cases in Los Angeles or something like that. Well, I don't take those cases. I used to do that a long time ago, but I don't anymore. I just stay in my three counties, basically.
Right.
So I have them filter that out right off the bat and then get basic facts about the case. You know, I want to know, is there an existing order in place or what kind, you know, if it's a divorce, where are they in the stage, who's filed, are there court dates, all that kind of stuff, the basic informational stuff, so I know what we're dealing with. And That really allows me to understand, are we a time is of the essence type of situation where they've been served with papers and there's a week to go for court, or is it a situation where they want to file against somebody, or is it a combination of those things, whatever it is.
Okay. And so really for them it's jurisdiction, basic facts. And the reason I ask is there's a lot of attorneys that, you know, are quite busy, you know, like you are, and don't always have the time to make that initial call to the leads, at least as close to real time as is best, right? And so they want to have a staff member, perhaps, you know, explore using a staff member to help them with making some of those initial calls. And there's some do's and don'ts about that, because what you can also do is if they talk too much about the case or get into the cost and so forth, or, you know, try to sell a consultation fee, sometimes you can start losing people just on the initial contact. So for you, they basically just find out jurisdiction, find out the basic facts of the case. If the client starts asking about the cost of your services, does Jackie or Denise get into it with them, or do they say that they need to speak with you about that?
If the client asks right off the bat, then yeah, they can, the ladies at the office, they can certainly address those things, but I don't typically have them address that unless the client broaches the subject first. I think it comes better coming from me when I talk to them a little bit about their case and I tell them this kind of tiered way of doing things to give them options. But if the client asks, of course, they don't pawn that off. Say, well, you have to ask Mr. Turgeon about that. No, they know how it all works and they can explain it, certainly.
Okay. So they have a good understanding of the different tiers, and they say, well, it really just depends on the amount of representation you want.
Right.
We have limited, we have this, we have that. So at least the client knows that they have a lot of options that you can you know, tailor to them to fit in the budget, basically.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But I don't want the staff saying, okay, well, Mr. Trigman does it this way and this way and this way, because like you say, there's, you can scare off people with that, throwing out numbers at them right off the bat kind of thing. And so, and you never know. You never know as you talk to them. Once they talk to me, sometimes they wanted a limited representation, but after they talk, they might want the full, you know, the full thing where you go in there. They just may feel more comfortable after talking with me. So you don't want to get numbers in their head unless they're actually asking first. That's the way I feel about it.
Yeah, I think really the only thing the client really needs to know at that stage is, you know, can you help them? Do you understand the situation? Can you get them path? And then second, do you have options that they can work, that you can work with them to fit in their budget? Is the finances going to be a problem or not? And if it's not a problem, that's it. They go, okay, well, he sounds like he can help me. He's got options that kind of fit people's budgets. Great. And then they can take the next step.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, really, the ladies in the office, Denise in particular, who does 95% of this, is it in an area where we can help them? And I need basic facts. So once I get on the phone with them, I can have an intelligent conversation with them. And be able to, before I even get on the phone with them, I've got a good feel for what the general idea of this case is, you know, kind of thing. So I go right into some questions and make it, and just like I said earlier, it's like, you know, these things where I want to tell you what you need to hear. I don't want to just dilly-dally and talk around just generalities. I want to get into some things with them right off the bat. So they feel confident in my services. They feel like I know what I'm talking about. And I think that direct approach helps, because I can't tell you how many of these contacts say, particularly ones that hire, but even ones that maybe can't afford to hire or, you know, want to come back, they say, I like the way you talk. You talk real straight to me. You get to the facts and get down to stuff quickly. And that's the way I've played it, and that's the way I've done it, because that's the way I am in life without everything. So that's the way I put it out there to the clients. It's no different sitting here talking to you right now, talking to my friends, or talking to a client. I just play it as straight down the fairway as I can.
Right, exactly. Okay, and so maybe we can shine a little bit more of a light on the types of options that you offer. So when they come in the door in the consultation, what are some things that you've learned to do that kind of help with getting that meeting forward? And maybe it's just a standard consultation like any other attorney does, but or is there anything that you do that makes that process a little more comfortable for the client, or and how do you kind of get down to what they need help with and then starting to figure out what the type of option they're going to choose financially as far as the amount of representation they want?
Yeah, it really comes down to, are they the petitioning party or the moving party or the responding party? Because if they're the ones coming in seeking to file something, whatever it is, divorce, motion to modify, guardianship, whatever it is, I want them to come in more, it's more of a talk session to find out what's going on to justify why they are going to ask the court for whatever it is they're going to ask the court, basically. As opposed to the person who is responding to somebody filing something against them, then it really comes down to this, if they're the responding party. I need to see what they filed against you, you know, some way. I need to see that. And if there are existing orders in place, I need to see those, because somebody's coming in asking for changes in something or to change a current situation. So I need to know where you stood before they filed this and what the person who's filing it against you is asking for. Those are critical for me to give them a good overview of what the next step would be. And then I can hear their side of the story, so I can tell them, okay, this is how it's going to fit in what's going on here, basically. So it's kind of I really want to know that right off the bat. Are they the responding party, or are they the petitioning or moving party right off the bat? And
gotcha.
And further than that is, when they're the petitioning or moving party, it's more of the meeting is a little bit less, how do I put this? It's less intense, in the sense that, you know, they're the ones coming and asking for. So I just let them kind of free flow and free talk a lot of this, and then we kind of craft, basically, okay, I know what you want to do. Okay, let's talk about some things, and even kind of almost strategize a little bit. But if they're the responding party, you know, the first thing is, not only are we responding, I need to see what the situation is, but what's our upcoming court date? What are our deadlines? What are we going to do? And what can we do inside these times, or do we need to get a continuance, or what do we need to do? So there's a little bit more of a triage kind of philosophy with that in the responding.
Yeah, it's almost like, yeah, it's like you're taking a more active role in, okay, you need to respond. You have this amount of time. Okay, here's exactly what needs to be done. Here's what you need to do next, da-da-da, as opposed to if they're petitioning, it's kind of on them to be the impetus to start this. So it's more like, well, what do you want to do? It's questions. It's more open-ended to get a feel for how they want to proceed.
So the other thing I do whenever they're in that responding type of situation is, because generally we have a time is of the essence situation. I like to ask a lot of the questions, and when they're the petitioning or moving party, I let them talk and just I listen and do a lot of listening and kind of hear the whole, want to hear everything, so I get an idea. But when they're responding, I'm also trying to size up how they're going to do on the stand right off the bat. You know, if they have to get on the stand or they have to testify, I want to size them up real fast because that time is of the essence. That's going to be my best chance to see how my client's going to do if they're going to have to testify in some way. And I'm not going to have a lot of time, you know, to get to know this client before we're going to be in court really quickly. So it's a great time to kind of be a little bit more aggressive with them and see how they respond to questions. So I do a lot more of the actual question, and then they provide an answer, question, answer thing, as opposed to when they're coming into petition, I just say, just, you know, spill your guts, tell me what's going on, basically.
Right. It's almost like, when they're petitioning, you're kind of sitting back in your chair and just listening and really kind of asking questions and so forth, whereas it's, oh, you need to respond? Okay, let's get right down to business, and you're kind of leaning forward and getting the work done. Right.
I think you have to. I mean, I feel you have to because, like I said, time is of the essence, and, you know, we could be in. I had one that just hired me from Unbundled yesterday, and we're going into court Friday, next Friday, not today, next Friday, and, you know, and I'm going to meet with her again next week, but, you know, that's going to be pretty much it. With my caseload and what I'm doing, I'm probably going to have that meeting yesterday and a meeting next week, and then we're going to court. And I have to be able to size that up and manage that real well before I get into court. And that's where I think a lot of the training in court from my past is good, in the sense that, you know, I've cross-examined witnesses and jury trials. So, you know, in situations where, you know, you have to manage the stuff real quickly and be able to handle high-volume witnesses and things like that, and that's where all that comes into play, and I think those skills just get developed by doing it over and over and over again.
Right, absolutely. Okay, and then so let's talk a little bit about, so one way or another, the client wants to move forward, whether he's petitioning or responding, and maybe we can talk about both scenarios and how it plays into how you, you know, maybe structure, but how do you start identifying the type of representation, you know, maybe we could also talk about how do you explain that to the client, like what would you say to a client, okay, so here's your options, do you first find out where they're at financially and then tailor accordingly, or do you kind of explain it to them and then ask them, you know, how much they can afford, you know, how do you start articulating and how do you say it to explain the tiers you offer, the unbundled services, the limited representation, and then the full representation?
Well, I always listen to everything about the case first and get through all of that stuff first and tell them in the consultation, this is what, you know, this is the path of which your case is going, what's going to happen. And then I always make a joke out of it and say, okay, now do you want the bad news? And, you know, they know what the bad news is. They go, yeah, what are your fees? And so we go through, then you know, that's kind of like the punchline to the consultation. I don't start that off. I don't walk in and say, okay, Archer, blah, blah, but that's always the punchline to the consultation. And,
right.
And then I go, and then I explain the whole tiering system with them, basically. But I want to make them at ease with talking with me about their case and feeling good about helping them in whatever way I can, and then I explain, okay, this is what I can do for you. Now, of course, like anything else, there's exceptions to the rule. There's certain clients that you have to, you know, they want to know right off. They don't even want to talk to you until they hear numbers. That's very few, though, I find. But there's few that say, I want to know, you know, what that's about right off. That's okay, fine. Tailor the consultation that way. There are, you know, some that they're unrealistic. You know, every once in a while you'll get one that's calling the thing. It's like legal aid, basically. And you have to, you know, you can kind of tell because as they're talking to you, they're telling you they have no money. They have no ability to pay. So you kind of like, you know, you don't understand as you're talking about their case, you say, you do understand that you're talking to an attorney that you have to pay money for, kind of thing. And so you kind of maybe bring them to Jesus a little bit quicker than you have to with more other people about the reality of hiring an attorney. Those are very, very small parts of it, though. I mean, those extremes are very, very small parts. Most of it is you go through the whole fact pattern, go, you know, explain the process, what they have to do, and then I hit them with the, you know, the punchline of, well, okay, this is what I can do to help you, and these are the ways I can do it, the different tiering system.
Right. Okay, yeah, and we have a lot of attorneys that either are still, you know, somewhat new to offering unbundled legal services and thinking about how to start structuring these types of creative options where they're working with clients on a more limited basis, or maybe even they're brand new to it. And, you know, well, I've always been trained just to do full representation, charge retainer up front and bill by the hour. What's the sum? I don't think, how does that work? So can you talk a little bit about how those more limited options work. Maybe get, I know every case is a little different depending on how much you're providing, but what typical fee structures are? Do you do it as a flat rate, and how much does it roughly cost? And maybe talk about the way in which you kind of craft those options with the client.
Sure. Well, and frankly, Dave, I prior to working with you guys, that's the way I did everything too, was just flat retainers, basically. I mean, I didn't have any of this tier system with other people, basically. But I saw what you guys were advertising and how you did this and what you were set up to do. So I said, well, let me rethink this and how I can work within this system. So this has been created in working with you guys. You can call it tier one, tier A. We don't really have a name for it. I call it tier one, but it doesn't mean anything, but just a name. But there's the one where I'm going to just basically, you know, you're going to prepare your own paperwork. You've probably already prepared your own paperwork. You just need some guidance or something like that. Now, I'm $250 an hour and typically what I charge. And what I say is, look, for a couple of hours, for 2 to 3 hours of work, I'm going to get, you know, we're going to organize everything for you. We're going to walk you through the whole process. We're going to explain everything. We're not going to be your attorney of record, and we're not going to be preparing documents, but we're going to guide you through. They can bring in the forms, and we can help them write it and put it all together for them, or put what they need to together. I also have a ton of guidance-type materials that I can provide to them and give to them for free, basically, which, and when I say free, I have it all. I just need to print it out and get it over to them, basically. And it's things that I've created over the years that really walk them through that. And a lot of the things I'm going to tell them verbally are the same things that are on these pieces of paper that they can take with them when they leave the office, that explain mediation. They explain things like the divorce process, if it's a divorce, things that explain guardianships, or whatever the type of case it is. They're all tailored to a particular case. And so I'm going to give them materials and sit down with them over a couple of hours, whatever it is, to help guide them through the process. And ultimately what I like to do is try and write a letter as well, kind of confirming the things that we went through, basically. And also, being very frank, it's kind of a CYA letter for my, you know, explaining them that, you know, we were giving you advice, we were giving you materials, but we are not your attorney of record, you know, just to cover our butt a little bit too, basically. So they don't.
Yeah, it becomes like a limited scope representation agreement in a way.
And even less than that, because I'm never really the attorney of record. So it's really because if the so-called person then goes to court and said, well, I met with his attorney, Tarigian, and he told me blah, 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 blah. Well, is he your attorney? No, he's not my attorney. He's just, you know, I have some documentation that shows we've never been the attorney. We were providing advice that they were paying for, basically. But then
right.
The second tier is the one where we're preparing documents for them. They're still representing themselves, but we're doing all their documents for them. And this is where my paralegal really comes in. She's there in the meetings with me, and we take all notes. We draft up everything, but then she does all the typing and preparation, basically. And whatever they pay, that, you know, I she's paid through that process and working for me, basically, for the time she works on it, because she's a paralegal that actually works in my office building and works for me and a couple of other attorneys doing other types of things. So she's an independent contractor, but I do quite a bit of work with her. And so that's a different scale. And so typically, and I should say, typically the tier one is about I told the client it's about $500 to as much as $750, determining how complex. So I figure that's 2 to 3 hours worth of my time that I'm involved. I try and keep it at about $500 unless it's a really, really complex type deal that requires another hour. And if I go over, I don't charge them for that because I've already told them it's going to land in that period of time. The tier two generally starts at anywhere from $750, 3 hours of time, all the way up to $1,500, determining how much paperwork we're going to have to prepare, how involved we're going to have to be in getting everything going. It typically lands about $1,000, though. And then finally, the last one is the full-blown representation, and that's what I say starts at $1,500. If it's a modification of any kind of things relating to support or any kind of modification in the case, it's actually a $3,000 retainer, and I ask for $1,500 down, and then I will work out a payment arrangement with them after that. Because once I'm in the $1,500 into a case, if I've worked that much time in the case, I kind of know what the case is going to end up being retainer-wise. And although the $3,000 is not a flat rate, I know if it's going to end up being, you know, $2,000 worth of work, $2,500 worth of work, it's going to be more than three or whatever else. And that's for a certain set of cases. And then if they're divorce cases, they're typically $4,000 retainers, and I ask for at least $2,000 down, basically, to get started. So about half of what the overall retainer is, and then we work out payment arrangements for the rest, typically.
And do you find, so we talked a little bit about Tier 1 and Tier 2, how much actual, you know, we've had a lot of attorneys actually give some great feedback on that type of Tier 2 model where, you know, they're having the documents prepared for the client, they're delivering the services for them. Does it end up taking you as individual lawyer time that many hours, the 750 to 1,000 or so many hours, like the 4 or 5 hours, or are you also at some level leveraging the time of the paralegal to do the drafting for you and maybe seeing a little bit a better hourly rate because it's a little bit less of your time, she's helping, that gets booked for less and so forth, but or is it just, is it the actual 4 hours every time?
I would tell you if I could do Tier 2 all day long. I mean, I like to go to court, though. I mean, me personally, I like being in court, things like that. But for an economic type of situation, the Tier 2 is the ideal. You're not stuck in court, you know, in a sense. That's where you really get eaten up in these things is the time spent waiting around and doing all that. Yes, you can charge the client for all that. Yes, you can do that. But then you've got clients, you know, getting frustrated and waiting around and all that kind of stuff. When you can prepare the stuff for them, give them good advice, and they're on their own kind of thing, that's, to me, you're getting the most bang for the buck. It's less money, but you're putting less time in, basically. I'm charging for my time, but like you said, I'm leveraging the paralegal time to get a lot of the typing done and all that kind of stuff. And so from a strictly financial, economic standpoint, you know, yeah, it's the most, that's the one where you get the most bang for your buck, really.
Yeah, this is kind of the myth, actually, that, you know, a lot of attorneys give as the reason why they don't do unbundled or don't offer these options is they think, oh, well, if it's less money, that means they're making less money. When in reality, what we found with, you know, most of our attorneys across the network is that, in fact, whether you're working for a client on a case for 30 hours or for 3 hours, it's still at least the same billable hour at $215 an hour. You're also not stuck with, you know, only a few clients where if one leaves, you've just lost 30% of your practice, for example. And then third of all, you have the opportunity to leverage some of your time or leverage some technologies because, you know, clients are very happy for the opportunity to work with an attorney for $750, $1,000, $1,500, even if they don't have an attorney doing the entire case. Most attorneys won't even touch a case for that amount. And so a lot of the attorneys will offer kind of a flat rate and then, like you said, kind of leverage your time a bit through the paralegal. And so the effective hourly rate could actually end up even being higher than the standard hourly rate because they can get the job done for $750 to $1,000, but it might only take you 2 or 3 hours of your own personal time. And so that starts to be, you know, very, very lucrative. And, you know, the clients are happy, you're happy. So, you know, that's the piece that I think, you know, a lot of attorneys that are reluctant to do this are missing is that it actually can be a very, very lucrative business model, especially given the marketplace we're dealing with today.
Well, I think it really comes down to this too, is people that are looking online, like through an unbundled attorney or any kind of thing like that, is they're looking for something that's going to be, they're looking for something, a representation and help that's going to be economical to them kind of thing. The people that have big, huge businesses and multi-million-dollar divorces and everything like that, let's just be straight about it. They know people that they're going to go. You're never going to. I don't mean to denigrate unbundled or anybody else, but they're going to go. There's somebody they know that does divorce law that does some big case where they're going to spend the $10,000-$20,000 for their divorce kind of thing. They're not going on
that's
the
right.
Internet. You're looking for the W-2 type people that are trying to just, they're getting a divorce or some child support or child custody thing that's come up or whatever it is. And they're trying to find a way to get through it. And sometimes they don't, you know, they can't really afford an attorney. They still need that help, basically, to take them all the way through it. Or they can't afford an attorney. They can't, you know, they can't go through that whole process. But here's a way to help those kind of people, those people in that particular kind of, you know, financial situation and that particular kind of thing, that you can give them good expert kind of quality advice. You can help them with their paperwork. You can get them in a way so it's not just them going to court and like a bloodbath in court for them because they're not prepared. And it's affordable for them, and that's
yes.
Why I think unbundled is really a really, really great vehicle for those types of things. And I don't mean to, you know, like I said, cast aspersions about things, but you're not going to get the people that are the, you know, the big movie stars kind of thing or whatever you're talking about doing these big. They're not going to be doing that. You're going to be getting a certain kind of clientele, and you want to be able to do it and make it affordable for them and give them the same kind of thing because in the end, the results are all the same. Whether you have the biggest divorce case in the world or a couple of people that are just making $20,000-$30,000 a year, the end results are still child custody, child visitation, child support, spousal. I mean, it's all the same answers when it comes down to it. It's still the same things that have to be addressed.
Yep. Yeah, and you're really making a big difference for these folks because devoid of an attorney like yourself, Marcus, that's willing to offer these types of options, they would literally be left to handle these things on their own. And like you said, if they're going into a contested matter or something like this without preparation, without understanding the court procedures, without having their documents prepared properly, and they really could end up in a situation where they're losing, you know, rights they should have.
Right. And I, you know, any attorney that listens to this and has gone to court and just sat in court waiting to have their case called, and you see all the pro pers doing this, they're completely unprepared. They've seen that. You guys have all seen the bloodbath that occurs out in these courtrooms when these things happen. You want, you know, it's uncomfortable to watch at times because you see these people that are completely unprepared, and it's just a destruction in there. And they may have some good points to work with, but they're never going to get them out. They didn't file their documents timely. They didn't put the pleadings together the right way. Their pleadings aren't done correctly. And it's just like you say, they may have some really good legal points, but they're never going to get to see the light of day because things weren't done correctly.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's what I really appreciate about what you're doing, and you know, a lot of the attorneys in our network is they're really making the difference. And have you found that, you know, by the clients working with you for that basis, getting the documents done, that you know you've had some clients that have had some success and it's made the difference for them?
Well, and I'm not trying to be braggadocious, but to be honest with you, I try and drive them to the tier two, but a lot of them, after they talk to me, they won't want to pay the $1,500 or the $3,000 or whatever. The guy like you, I want to hire you to just handle the whole thing. So what happens
sure.
is they end up doing that. Now, I do get my tier two stuff as well, but I personally would like more of it to be the tier two. I think it's more, you know, me personally think it's more bang for the buck. Because once I get into tier three, then I'm back to scheduling court dates and court appearances and clearing calendars and all that kind of stuff, which I don't mind, but then it takes into account all of those other things that come up basically and dealing with, you know, the court scheduling and all those types of things, which takes time and takes money. And certainly I don't mind them taking me to tier three, and I don't mind getting hired for that. But, you know, at the same time, it's actually my practice so far with Unbundled has been most of the retainers have, I would say 80% have been the tier three type, you know, kind of thing.
Yep. Yep.
Which
and then do you
I'm
also find
that. I'm not complaining. I don't want to.
That's good too. You know, that works. And it sounds like, you know, you're being very reasonable with, you know, if you have a 3,000 retainer, taking half down and working payment plans, and maybe we can explore that a little bit too. But, you know, that's a testament too, the fact that you're being flexible even on the tier three option. So that makes it a lot more easier for people to pull the trigger there.
Yeah, I try to be. That's just my philosophy. It's just not the place. You want to help these people get through a very, very uncomfortable situation and a very bad situation without having complete scorched earth. I'm not interested in adding to that for them by having some attorney gouging them for money and, you know, making promises. I just don't see the point of any of that. You're just going to get people hating you eventually, and I just don't see the point. There are other areas of law where I, you know, when I do criminal defense cases, and not that it relates to this, but I've represented some, you know, some heavy hitting type cases, murder cases and things like that. They have to spend the money. The work has to be done. You know, it's not just paying it to me, but it's the time in trial and the time to investigate and hire experts. They pay, you know, you have to pay big money for stuff like that if you want a good criminal defense case done. But here, you know, changing child support or modifying child support or changing the visitation plan, I just don't see the point of people having to spend $5,000 to $10,000 just to modify little Johnny going with his dad for one extra day a week. I don't see what you have to litigate about. Get into court, get it done quickly, and go battle it out. And if you have to, and try and get that result for the client, basically. And
yep,
back
exactly.
Core values that the more reasonable you are, the more straightforward you are, the better results you're going to get. So.
Right. And up till now, we've been talking primarily about family law, but I think maybe it was a few months ago you started taking immigration leads and working more with immigration clients we've been sending you. Can you talk a little bit about those immigration cases and those immigration leads, and perhaps if the process is any different in the way in which you relate to them, the sales process, for example, like that initial meeting, if it takes longer, do you end up meeting with a couple more times, or maybe just talk about some of the differences and some of the strategies you've developed to be to do well with the immigration cases.
Well, yeah, now immigration, when you guys opened up this wing of Unbundled for Immigration, I was very interested because I'd already started building up my immigration practice. But immigration is completely different than family law. It's a completely different kind of deal because there's not this emotional aspect to immigration that there is family law, although people may be getting deported or whatever else. But it's a much more it's a much calmer type situation. So what we do is we – like anything else, we take the initial contact, we do an intake, and it's a very thorough intake. Unlike the family law, you do basically getting a basic information about the case, but we have a very extensive, about a 5-page intake for immigration that we need to get a lot of information for. And once we get that intake, I need to review that because there's a bunch of disqualifiers right off the bat before I'm even going to schedule a consult with them. There's a lot of things that when you see once they do this intake, you can't even help these, but there's nothing to do for them because a lot of things they don't really understand have precluded them from ever applying for certain things, at least under the state of the law as it stands right now. We'll do a follow-up call and tell them, you know, and do a short call, and even sometimes I try and call them and explain it to them, but there's nothing to consult about, you know, because there's no way to really help them. At the same time, if there's any way to kind of help them, and there's generally two types of immigration cases I see in the Central Valley practices, it's either some kind of removal type situation where the immigration, the INS has got a hearing going and they're talking about removing, you know, the person, deportation, removal type situation. Or it's a person that's petitioning for legal permanent resident type situation to eventually become a citizen. So there's not any kind of court proceeding going, but they want a petition to try and get to become legal, so to speak. The ones that are trying to petition for their LPR status, their green card, you know, you want to get that intake so you can see, can we fit them under one of the, you know, many rubrics of immigration that we can, you know, get them their green card and fit it in under. And then it also helps determine for us, you know, what kind of forms we're going to have to fill out, what applications we're going to have to do, and what the fees are going to be, because there's different fees for whatever the type of work we have to do. So it allows me to, before I even get on the phone with them or meet with them, to know how we're going to drive the case. If it's a deportation removal type situation, once again, just like court, it's time is of the essence type thing. So you want to know when their next hearing is. Luckily, the immigration court is one of those things that when you get a continuance, if their hearing is coming up real close and they've hired you now, they've just walked in and hired you to help them with this, and you go and get the court and file a motion for continuance and get it. Luckily, what's nice about that is, you know, you don't, continuance isn't like next week or 2 weeks later. It's like 6 months later half the time. So it gives you more than enough time to get involved in the case and do what you need to do. It can even be longer than that. And
right.
The only difference is that immigration, the two immigration courts I deal with are Los Angeles and San Francisco, mostly San Francisco. And my big limiting factor on the intake is, are the people from here, are from the areas where I work, Fresno County, Kings County, Tulare County, because I need to have that interaction with them on a regular basis. Even though their case may be in San Francisco, I don't want to have a guy that lives in Los Angeles, has a case in San Francisco, and I'm in the Central Valley. It's just too hard to be. And, you know, people say, well, you can do stuff by email and everything else, but you need to have that face-to-face contact with the client, basically, in this stuff, to show them what you're doing and really interact with them. And so that jurisdictional
right.
issue comes in. And then the other thing that really with immigration that really has to I have the staff really deal with is the language issue, too. What language are we dealing with? Because sometimes they have documents that have to be translated, that we need to have transcribed and translated as exhibits for part of our petitions. And most time it's Spanish, but I've got one coming in next week with Arabic. And I had one 3 weeks ago that was Hmong. So, and you got to find, and I don't have ready to go Hmong interpreters and Arabic interpreters just sitting in my office waiting, you know, ready to go. My paralegal and my staff, they speak Spanish fluently, so they can at least read through the documents, but, you know, to get an idea of what we're dealing with. But you've got to kind of plan that out a little bit more. So there's a little bit more deliberation when I'm dealing with an immigration case.
And so if you're working with someone that speaks a language that you don't have someone in the staff that speaks that language, how do you go about working with that? And so do you bring in interpreters into the office, or what's the strategy to work around that?
Well, luckily, over these years in doing criminal law, I've represented doing criminal defense, I've represented just about every kind of language there is in representing people, because I have an appointments contract with Tulare County. So I get appointed cases out of Tulare County that the public defender can't handle, or overflow contracts. So I've represented just about every different type of language you can think of. And whenever I'm in court and we have a different language client, I make sure I get the interpreter, the court-appointed interpreter, I make sure I get all their business cards, basically. So I have a whole Rolodex of different type of business cards, of different type of interpreters, their business cards, that I can call upon, and I always go and make contact with them and talk with them and tell them what I'm doing so they're not surprised. And I, be very frank, I've always made friends with the interpreters in court. I believe they're one of your greatest assets in court. So I'm not trying to be too much of a smart aleck here, but the judge is the person I have a relationship with the judge, but I feel like your bailiffs and your court reporters and your court clerks and your interpreters are just as important in there, because they're going to help you with things you may need in practicing. So I have that access, and I just need to know what language I'm dealing with so I can call up the people I need to find to come in and do that kind of work for me.
Right. And so when you have scheduled consultations, they'll come in. Yep. Do you ever have an interpreter do a three-way call when you're initially making contact with the lead, if it's determined that it's a language that your staff can't speak?
Sometimes. Yeah, sometimes. I will
Is
tell
that
you
necessary
that
sometimes?
Yeah, it is necessary. I will tell you, since I've been doing the immigration with you, I've only had three that weren't Spanish. So it hasn't come up that frequently yet. I think I mentioned one of the actually two of them have been recent. So it's not a thing where it's something that, like I said, that's why it takes more deliberation, because it happens so infrequently. I can, if we get a contact with the client, and a lot of times the person that's calling, even if the client speaks, I'm just going to use Arabic, the person that's calling us is a family member that speaks English, basically. So they can kind of tell us what's going on. And so we'll schedule that appointment out, you know, even though we made contact. A lot of times the family law ones, we try and get them in the next day. But the Arab, like if it was Arabic, I'm just using that as an example, we may kick it out a week. And so it gives us enough time to schedule what we need to get the interpreter available, kind of thing. And that, and the nice part about immigration, unless they're going through a deportation hearing the next day or something like that, a week later is not a big deal. I don't find that to be that big deal. If they're petitioning for something, they're okay with all of that. The only ones that are in court on a deportation, and then you need to get them in as quick as possible. I haven't had one of those yet that was a different language besides Spanish, so I can handle it if it's Spanish for them to come in the next day or that afternoon or whatever is necessary.
Right. Yeah, and you mentioned that the intake is a little bit longer. You've got maybe five pages because you need to determine, you know, get a lot more information, determine if there's barriers and so forth. Do you have your staff do that intake over the phone when they first make that call to that lead and kind of get all that information?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so they do the intake, kind of fill out all that documentation, and then does your staff say, okay, we're going to get this reviewed and then get back to you to set up a consultation?
Right, that's exactly. Well,
okay.
Well,
so it's kind of a two-step, as opposed to them talking to them, getting the facts, and then scheduling. It's, you know, talking to them, fill it out, then review, then call them back and schedule, kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah.
Unless it's clear that it's 100% good to go, hey?
Well, typically I don't let the staff make that decision. I have them fill out that's never happened. They fill out the question, they fill out the intake, they get it to me, and I'll tell them, you know, I'll see it that night or that afternoon or whatever. So if they'll call them back today and get them set up for a consultation, or if there's, you know, this doesn't look good. And I have a couple of colleagues. I don't think I've ever turned one away completely yet, because even one of what there's a few we couldn't help, but I still want to talk to them on the phone and explain why. But if I don't think there's any door open, I try and double check with some colleagues of mine and some treatises I have, just to make sure I'm not missing something that may be an avenue for them that's not right on, you know, that's some kind of, maybe there's some kind of real unique way to pull it off. We did have one like that about a couple of months ago, and they are a client of the firm right now. We're going through it, that we had to, you know, we had to find a kind of circuitous way to get it done, but we figured it out, kind of thing. So we developed it the right way. It worked out well. The only thing that's different with immigration, the way I do it, in the sense that I don't have any tiering system on representation. You're either hiring me to handle the case for you or you're not, basically, and we set the fee schedule. So it's a little bit different with immigration, because there's no just come in and I'll give you advice, or come in and I'll prepare paperwork but not be your attorney. I you know, it's one of those things, because I'm dealing with a federal court. I'm not going to monkey around with that thing. It's either It's either you're hiring me to help you do this, or you know, all the way through, or not. I'm putting my name on it. I'll work with a payment plan with them. Once we determine what the fees would be, I'll work with them on that. But I don't do any kind of tiered representation there.
Right. And you know, maybe I'll ask one more question about immigration, then we'll wrap it up. I appreciate your jumping on and sharing so openly. Is there anything different in the consultation with immigration? Obviously, you're dealing with completely different facts, getting a lot of different kinds of information and so forth, but just in the way in which you communicate about your services and what you can do, like, for example, you know, I would assume it would be the same, where you get all the information, you ask questions, you find all the facts, and then there's that punchline moment. Is there a little bit difference in the way in which you communicate? Maybe because it's a different demographic, they're immigrants, so they may not have the same level of trust, or it's not as emotional. Are there any differences in the way in which you work with the clients and describe your services than perhaps, say, family law, once you get to the point where you start talking about what you can do for them?
Absolutely. It's completely different. Family law versus immigration are completely different. I'm a completely different dynamic of attorney in immigration versus family law. Family law, it just is exactly what you said. No matter whether you're the petitioning or the responding side, there's that emotional thing that's going on. You're part therapist for that client. You know, you're part psychologist for them. As much as you're a lawyer, you're trying to, you know, manage their emotions and get them to understand what's going on. Immigration has none of that, basically. I know it's emotional if so-and-so is going to be deported or something like that, but it's more clinical. What is your situation? And let's find out how long you've been here, what's going on, everything. It's more fact-gathering. You just got to gather a lot of information from them. And as much information as you can get, and as you gather all of that, you begin to craft in your mind how what's the path by which we can take you through this process to get you what you need to stay in the country, whatever method it is. Because that's the ultimate goal. I want to stay here, basically. And I want to stay here legal. So the goal is always the same. I want to become legal. I want to stay here. I don't want to be kicked out of the United States. Okay. So we all know the end result. So what path are we going to take to get you there, basically? And it's much more relaxed, I find. Immigration is much, because it's really a question and answer. It's, you know, I need to just get information. As we get information, you know, we're going through the process and gathering. And as they provide the information, the questions start to reveal the solutions start to reveal themselves as you walk through the process 99% of the time. Family law is completely different. You can't, you know, people say, I want to fight for this kid or for my child, or I want to fight for a support or whatever. The answers are not that clear right off the bat. There's a lot of things that are still in flux with that. So it's a matter of managing those expectations of the client and keeping things all kind of in play, where immigration, it really kind of, many times I think it resolves itself very early on.
Right.
It's just a very, very different dynamic between attorney-client. Very different.
Okay. All right, and so then you kind of get all that information. It's a question and answer. Then you start to determine the path. You kind of highlight and explain what that path is. And then is there also a little bit difference in the way you say, okay, and it's going to cost this to do this, it's going to cost this? Do you have to be kind of more black and white about this is the fee? We had some other feedback from other attorneys that say they just have to be very clear, this is what it costs. This is the fee. They just want to know the cost. Maybe you can share a little bit about how you kind of deal with the money a little bit more when you're dealing with immigration client versus family law.
I think that's it. I think exactly what you said. It's a very, very straightforward type situation. I know if I'm going to take them an I-130 type petition, I know what that's going to cost. I know what the fees are. I tell them, this is what it costs. Now, once I tell them that, there's no playing around with the fee. If they say, well, I can't pay all that. All right, well, are you interested in using our services? Can you put down this much? But then you have to make payments every month. There's a real regimented kind of deal for them to keep doing. And they understand that I'm not going to file anything until at least some portion of the payments are made or whatever else. It's a real, real structured type of situation. And so it's very different. And then there's a lot of costs, too, to these things. You know, there's filing fees. There's the biometrics. There's sometimes with the translating of documents, you have to hire somebody to just, you know, certify people to translate documents. There's a lot of other type fees that go into this. So there's costs on top of that. You have to take that all into account, basically. And I have a fee schedule that's all set out that I've created. So what all I have to do is figure out, okay, I'm going to take them through this type of scenario, what are the fees and costs associated with that, because it's all pretty much spelled out. All the costs are spelled out by the immigration court, and I have a good fee structure that I've taken from, you know, practicing this and doing this and drawing from, you know, learning from other attorneys and learning from other resources what it costs to do this kind of procedure, basically.
Right. And because I would assume because immigration has, you know, time intervals of, you know, sometimes 3 months, sometimes 6 months, does it give you the flexibility to be able to say, to make a little bit more of a, I don't know, lenient payment plan where that maybe they would, you don't necessarily take $1,500, you could do $5, and then every few months you can kind of do as a pay as you go at each step? Do you kind of break it up sometimes by the steps involved with the immigration process?
Absolutely.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, okay. So phase one is we need to file this. That's, I need this amount for, to do this phase. And then for phase two is, then we need to do this, and that I'll need this amount to complete that. Is tend to go kind of structured in that way?
Yeah, exactly. I used to be transactional work, but I find it to be very transactional in nature, is that you're preparing documentation for them, and although it's going to a court and there is the potential for some litigation, I find it to be very transactional. You're doing certain documents for this fee, you're doing certain documents for this fee. And I know it's still litigation, but it doesn't feel that way. It feels like you're just preparing documentation when you're doing it. I know it sounds very esoteric, I guess, but when I'm doing family law, the pleadings are geared towards knowing we're going to be going to court to be battling something out. You know, it's a whole different type of feel to things.
Right, as opposed to fill in the blanks and, you know, check all the boxes so you get, you know, it gets through the process. You know, as opposed to preparing a case to defend, yeah, unless it's
exactly you're preparing your paperwork to go to war, so to speak, in family law, in a battle, where I don't really feel like I'm going to battle in immigration court. I feel like I'm preparing the necessary documents because I'm, in my mind, I've got an idea of what's going to be successful for them before we ever start filing the thing. I've kind of done my pre-planning ahead of time. Where in family law, you file your allegations, you go, and now you go and fight for the things you're trying to get accomplished, kind of thing. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah. Yes, it does. That makes complete sense. Absolutely.
I did a lot of bankruptcy, and bankruptcy has started to wane, you know. But bankruptcy was always one of the things, before we ever filed a Chapter 7 or 13, we did our own kind of like bankruptcy kind of like plan to make sure it was going to fly. We would analyze the whole thing and really prepare it well before we ever filed our petition for bankruptcy, unless it was an emergency type thing. We always want to make sure that, you know, and there's the means test. There's all these things you have to do to make sure it's going to really fly. Look at all the debt, look at everything. And you almost do like an estate plan, a bankruptcy estate plan, to make sure this case is going to go through. And yeah, there's always glitches as you go down the road, but you deal with them because you kind of anticipate where the maybe pitfalls are. But you know, before you ever put pen to paper, you know, or file something, you know kind of that this is going to be, it's going to have a good chance of going. Same thing kind of with immigration, where in family law, although you file and ask for certain things, it's still kind of up in the air.
Yeah, because it's always up to the judge to decide. I mean, and it's the same in immigration. It could still get denied, but it's still there's more of a decision happening one way or another, and there's a lot of different variables to determine that decision when it comes to family law.
In family law, that overriding thing, and almost all family law relates to children. You know, the big family law battles are around children. There's that standard in California being the best interest of the children. Well, what is that? That's what the judge decides is the best interest of the children. It's a kind of vague phrase. So the judge can use that phrase. That's the law. You can qualify anything as what's the best interest of the children. Where in immigration, you know, you say if you meet these criteria, you can apply for this LP, you know, for this green card. If you don't check off certain boxes, you're out, basically. Kind of thing. It's
right.
It's much more yes or no. That's the only way I can express it. Black and white, a lot more black and white in immigration as opposed to family law, where it's very, very, you know, shades of gray.
Yep. And so I guess just the last question is, you've been working with us for, you know, about a month or, you know, a year or so, taking a lot of leads, you know, probably in the hundreds now. Is there anything else, generally speaking, that you've developed over these months and fielding leads over and over that has helped you with, generally speaking, being successful with fielding the leads?
Well, really that tiered thing, like I said, before I started with Unbundled, I never had tiered representation like that. It was either you're going to hire me to handle your case or not, basically. So when I first started with you guys, I didn't have that either. And over the, you know, 2-3 months, and I still am always developing that. You know, I'm kind of always, every month I kind of look at it and make sure we, you know, we're kind of massaging. And we meet every couple of weeks, staff, and we go over things and talk about stuff and make sure it's, you know, whatever we can do to kind of even refine it more. But that tiered system of doing things, that's probably the biggest refinement I've made since doing this, in the sense that it changed the way I kind of looked at doing family law. And like I said, I really actually enjoy some of the tier one, tier two. As much as attorneys will think, well, I only want that one where they're hiring me for the full bore, I kind of like the tier one, tier two representations a lot of times. I'm not saying I make a whole practice out of it, but it allows for different ways to help people besides just go to court with them and go battle it out, you know. And I think there's other ways you can help people. They're going to go, they're going to, you know, certainly go to court and everything, but there's other ways. And I think it has a kind of organic kind of way about it, in the sense that you help these people, you set it all up for them, and maybe they didn't need an attorney to go to court with them, and it still helped them. It got them a good result, basically. And so they're happy. I think that's the most important thing, is making people, you know, happy with the results and happy with the representation. So the more options you can provide, the more things you can do for the client, the better off you are, basically. So that's the biggest change in my practice since doing working with Unbundled is this tiered kind of concept. And like I said, it's not perfect. I'm always kind of trying to see how I can make it even better and more useful to the client and things like that. So I'm always tweaking it.
And sometimes, yeah, sometimes
those tweaks work and sometimes they don't, you know.
Right. Yeah, we've done some really great episodes with, you know, attorneys like Brad Lotta, who's been working with us for, you know, over 2 years now, I think, and Les Sandoval. And we really dive into kind of the unbundled options they use and how they structure it and the flexibility. So, you know, we'll be sure to pass along those episodes as well, so you can listen to those and start getting some ideas so you can start honing your craft in the tiers and maybe come up with some other options you hadn't considered before as well, too.
Okay, sounds good.
All right. Well, listen, Marcus, I want to thank you so much for taking the time here and sharing kind of how you've been doing this, especially your comments about immigration were especially helpful, too, because we have a lot of attorneys that, you know, immigration is still, you know, only a few months. You know, this is recorded in April, so it's still somewhat new. So those comments are really valuable, and I really just appreciate your time, the work you're doing for the clients. I mean, the amount of clients we're sending you and the amount of clients that are electing to hire you is a lot of folks. So we really appreciate the work you're doing, and I'm sure they do, too.
I appreciate that. Thank you for the time yourself. I know it's a Friday afternoon, so sitting here talking about this stuff, I appreciate you spending the time with it as well.
Yep, absolutely. So with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up. And so thank you again for jumping on today. And for everyone else that's listening, I hope you enjoyed the episode, and we'll see you on the next one. Thanks again for listening. For more information about how our lead generation services can help you grow your practice, visit our website at www.unbundledattorney.com. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please be sure to subscribe so you get each new episode as soon as it's available, and leave us a rating and review on iTunes. Once again, thanks for listening.